It's Tuesday, August 20th, 2024, and you're listening to episode 626 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 40 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Caleb.
This is Doug.
And this is Mary.
I remember years ago when my family got an Apple IIc computer. So this is back before even Macintosh existed. Mm-hmm. I realize that I'm once again dating myself here, but that's all right. But when we got our Apple IIc, we got, obviously, well, my brother and I and my sisters as well, started collecting video games to go with it. And I remember one of the things that was readily available on computer that at the time was not available yet on console, because the NES had not come along with some of the early JRPGs or whatnot. And that was
Oregon Trail.
Yes, yes. Oh. I mean, sort of.
I played a lot of Oregon Trail.
I'm actually going to agree with the mention of Oregon Trail, because what I was going to say was computer role-playing games or CRPGs. But honestly, isn't Oregon Trail kind of a...
Especially when you get into like Oregon Trail 2 and you have more choices and more ability to rename your characters.
You create a character, you buy equipment, you deal with encumbrance, and then as you have random encounter tables, and you have taverns, except they're forts that you stop in at along the way. And
absolutely.
Occasionally you have resource management.
And then you go into combat against everything living.
and then you die of dysentery.
Just clear
cutter. Or you drown fording the river.
Precisely. Just base first skill save, you fail. Which, you have a better save if you're playing the... What was it, the carpenter as opposed to
the banker, because you can buy everything, but
so you don't have jack squat when you start. But there's other games like that in there that I would consider much more traditional RPGs, games like Temple of Apshai, the gold box games,
King's Quest.
I would call that more of an adventure game than an RPG.
That's true.
The walk north, get you flask, you can't get you flask sort of games. And I'm not against those. I loved those games.
Oh, sure.
The Infocom games in particular were absolutely my jam. But I remember those being a pretty simple gateway back over to role-playing games, because the principles in them were very much based on tabletop role-playing games.
Sure.
In fact, one of the video games that I first really got into that was an RPG was the Crescent Hawk's Inception, which is a Battletech video game. It's, I believe, the first Battletech video game. And that was what ended up getting me hold of my first FASA catalog. Mm. And then from there, getting Star Trek, and then eventually Shadowrun, and finally Battletech. And I think there were all those games, and they provided a pretty clean gateway back into tabletop RPGs because of the fact that, for the most part, they were tabletop RPGs or were taken very shamelessly from it. I forget the game, but someone actually told me what Wasteland is based on, that apparently it's ripped off from, like, GURPS or something. I forget.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, yeah, I forget which RPG it is, but someone told me what it was. So that transition was fairly obvious and fairly easy, apart from one thing, which is the change in the degree of freedom. That was the only spot where I found that people who played video games tend to struggle a bit. Now, if you'll excuse my prattling over the past few minutes, Caleb, you were actually the one that brought this up earlier. And I'm curious, what's the context you encountered this in?
Well, sure. So I've been running a Facebook group for TTRPGs for the local area, as well as a Discord, and running some events at a location here that runs a D&D night. So I've kind of been managing that. And one of the things that we've been getting a lot of over the last several months, at least, have been people coming from things like Baldur's Gate 3 and coming in and saying, I've been playing these Baldur's Gate games and I really want to find a real tabletop experience to come and play. Where can I go? How do I get into it? what do I need to have to start? And we've been bringing these people into an open night and trying to encourage them to step out of their video game mindset and be able to open up to this open world storytelling experience that they've not had any access to until recently.
I think Baldur's Gate in particular is interesting because you skip one of the hurdles that you often have in learning RPGs, which is the rules. Because yeah. Baldur's Gate 3 is just 5th edition, even with you can even roll dice on the screen. And so, like, you don't have that. It's literally just getting under the mindset mm-hmm. of, this is not the computer game, this is, you can do all of these things you couldn't do with correct. Computer.
Huh. Yeah, it's a big difference and jump, especially when you have simple, I mean, you could talk about Fallout 4 and some of these other systems where they're open world, realistically, but when it comes down to it, it's all if-then statements. If this situation happens, this happens, and it may feel more role-playing game-like because the system has so many options.
But they are ultimately finite options because they have to be programmed.
Yeah, not just finite, but relatively limited. Yeah.
Correct.
So it's not just finite, but once again, you're talking 3, 4, 6 options to choose from. You're not talking about the depths of human imagination. But I wonder if there is a jumping-off point there. Because one of the things that we've championed in the past is that when someone seems stuck in a role-playing situation, it's sometimes helpful to point out the buttons and levers mm-hmm. to say, okay, you're in a room, there's this clue toward a murder you're trying to solve, and this is going on, that's going on. What do you want to do? And by the way, there's a dresser across the room you haven't looked in. There's a chalk line where the body was you could look at, and there's a scratch mark by one of the doors, or you can choose to do none of these things.
There's also a police officer standing over there that you could go talk to. Yeah, all of the options.
But what I'm curious, Caleb, is in your recent experiences, is simply dangling that last part of that question there enough to start getting people to turn their wheels in other ways? Of saying you could do this, this, and this, or something else that you think up on your own, and do people eventually start to chafe under the existing choices and try that one?
What I found easier is the carrot than the stick. You know, the stick being that you're saying, here's the buttons to press and the levers to pull, is more of descriptive language, using that to encourage their and pique their interest. Is what I found. I run a couple of scenarios because we run one-shots, and I run them to try to incorporate, you know, a little bit of investigation, a little bit of role play, and a little bit of combat. I try to avoid the combat as much because it is 5e. You're going to have it in there, but everyone gets into 4 combats in a 4-hour session, and then that's all you do. So I try to incorporate those other elements and to encourage their interest and their trying to find things, as I try to make sure that I have those use descriptive words when describing a specific area that I want them to highlight without saying this is a lever. You know, I'll talk about the room that they're going into or whatever they're describing, the space that they're going into, and then I'll slip in some nice characteristic words of the jewelry box that I want them to look at, that it's a little extra shiny there, and then but I'll roll past it, but I'll say it in a nice descriptive way that might draw their attention to it, but not force them to say, that's what you need to look at.
How long, though, do you think it takes on average, accepting here that we're talking about a relatively minimal sample size,
sure,
for someone to first say, I'm not going to pick A, B, or C. I'm going to write my own D.
That happens just as much as in any role-playing game. When you're, you know, I expect them to go left, they're going to go right. I feel like in my experience so far, as long as I provide several carrots in a room, they're going to hit one of them at least.
Yeah.
And then I can sometimes write the clue into the 3 different carrots that I'm going to give them and make that clue be specific to that item or specific to that thing they're looking at. And that leads them either to the other clues or potentially, you know, to the next stage that I need them to get to.
So have they came in with preconceived notions on it? And what of those have you noticed that they came in thinking? Did they think it was going to be exactly like a video game? You following me?
So I found mostly so far is that they come in and they don't know what to do. it's more of the analysis paralysis. I have so many options. What are you asking me to do? They're looking for those levers to pull. And I don't find that they have anything that they're specifically stuck on other than I have no idea where I am other than that. So I try to draw them out as a person individually, and I try to call out to specific players when I'm talking about something, you notice this, or you notice that. Sometimes I'll have them roll perception checks or whatever the mechanic is, and if that person doesn't get it, if I go through three perception checks throughout some different things or three types of checks, and they are not the ones who are highlighted, I'll mm-hmm. intentionally call them out in some way to create a reason why they're the druid. They happen to notice it because it's made of wood, and it's this specific type of wood, and so I'll call something out to them. Hey, you notice this is hickory, where everything else you've seen has been maple.
Okay.
How much time do you spend helping them develop their character beyond stats? Not just, you know, here's your attributes, here's your skills, mm-hmm. here's your equipment, but who is this person? What motivates this person? There's a specific reason I'm asking this, mm-hmm. but I'll give you a moment to answer first.
So what I've been trying to do, because a lot of these I'm handing them some pre-generated characters, I don't assume what their character is going to be, but I do go into there. One of the things I'll talk about in the first step is I give them a preconceived notion of where they are, why they're there, what they're doing. And then I'll try to describe, you know, I'm describing a room, as like I was talking about. So pulling the carrots idea again.
Yeah.
I will generally go, if you're looking, we're all going to investigate this room. What would make it interesting to your character? What would your character want to be looking for? Because you're looking at a room, it looks like a normal room. You're telling me you want to investigate it. You want to look around and look for stuff. What kind of things would pique your interest? Would it be, you know, if you're a nature style character, would you be interested in the nature stuff? And I try to, because I've described the room, and then I try to encourage them because they're looking for hidden clues. And then I try to base my results, that whatever, that they, if they won, if they did really well on their roll, try to base the results based on that.
So yeah. It's less that you're expecting them to have a fully, to come up with a character when they get handed the sheet.
Correct.
And more that you're sort of trying to pull a character out as you go along.
Yeah, because we have a 4-hour block, and we're, you know, I don't want to spend an hour and a half developing their characters, and then they go, well, I didn't understand what I was talking about at stage one, because I've never played a character before.
The reason I was asking about that is because I tend to hit issues of analysis paralysis or tyranny of choice, or whatever you want to call it, in video games far more often than I do role-playing games.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. In a role-playing game, assuming the game master has offered me anything interesting to interact with, mm-hmm. that this isn't just a dead fish of a GM, which I have played under and it is freaking torturous. But assuming this is a GM that's actually got something there and is responding to my input, then because I know who that character is and what that character's interested in and what the character's motivations are and what sort of individual plans or ideas they've got cooking in their head, that I can typically jump to something, or failing something in the environment that the game master's described, I can invent something and jump over to it, because I am focused first and foremost on who this person is. This person, we all use Dr. Proust from the Blades in the Dark game. This person wants to create a religious cult based around certain ideas and certain beliefs about the dead. And so whenever the opportunity comes up to interact with the dead, to spread these ideas, whatever, that's what he's going to be out there doing. Now, conversely, where I have that issue is over in video games, where I'll start up a game like, let's say, Skyrim. And once you get past the part of the game where you're being fairly led by the nose with a dragon mm-hmm. at your ass, and I'm just standing there out in the middle of nowhere, I can go anywhere, do whatever I want, now suddenly I lock down. I don't know what to do anymore, because I'm not thinking about this character as a person. This character is really just an avatar for me that just has certain stats and a certain setup to allow a play style for me. But really, it is a very, very thin veil for me. And so if I can't figure out what it is I personally want to do in this world or find anything that I personally latch onto, then my character just wanders in circles for a bit before I save the game, close it out, and don't come back to it.
I mean, that's exactly what I did with Skyrim for a slightly different reason, but it's similar in that you hit that point where it's completely open world, and suddenly it's like, okay, there's a couple of things I could do, but I feel like none of them have any consequence outside of this area and this thing that I just did. There's no overarching story that would help guide further decisions. It's just an explore.
And some of that is the way it was written. For example, Skyrim, where there are sections where they didn't provide a strong enough pull at X point, you know, where you didn't get a quest that was really pulling you this direction, and you didn't have a very good quest hook to want you to go that way. And it ends up, you end up like, oh, where do I go next? And I've been the same exact spot several times. I mean, same thing with the Fallout series. It's so open-worlded that unless you're following what Preston Garvey wants you to do on the Fallout 4, and he keeps going, hey, listen, you know, come do these things, unless you follow those
clues. He's kind of Fallout 4's Navi.
I was going to say, he's very Navi-esque.
Yeah, isn't he? I didn't think about that. Hey, listen, there's a settlement that needs your help.
Exactly. And I've been redoing another playthrough of that just because it's, you know, the new show.
I never even thought of him as assuming Fallout 4's Navi. And you're right. He is. Oh my gosh.
He's not as bad, though, because he's not following you constantly, unless you take him as a companion, which I never do, because...
Oh, no. I actually would actively run from him, because if he gets to you and even gives you the quest, then a timer is started before that settlement gets torn up. If you don't go there, the settlement will get torn up. Doesn't matter how well defended you have it.
Oh,
yeah. And so, yeah, I would run from him, because even receiving the quest was the beginning of the end.
Once you own the settlement or whatever, that's for sure. But yeah, the having that open world concept mentality where you're dealing with video games and you have this whole like idea of I can just go anywhere, you get the dual paralysis. One is, I want to go see it. I don't know if I want to go see anything. What do I want to do? What's the big thing? Or the reverse of, I want to do everything, and so I have 1,000 side quests, and I'm constantly figuring out what's the next thing I want to do, and I'm just picking out these weird things that have no meaning in the long run.
Right, none of it amounts to a cohesive anything.
Correct. It's not an overarching story like you get in a D&D campaign where I can give you, every week I can just give you a new random quest, but that's not really fulfilling. But it's not going to run, you know, consistent running story that where there's a reason for me killing the rats in the basement.
Or even if it is random things every week, you as a human being running the game can be like, well, this happened over here, so now this does affect this other random thing that is going on now.
Correct.
You can weave them together in a way that a pre-programmed game cannot.
At least for now. But the biggest thing is trying to get the characters to understand that this is not a video game, to get them to that point where they're saying, I can not just pick up the objects, but I could choose whether I want to help the creature or kill the creature. You know, and there's all sorts of different pathways and moralities that you could play into it, which you could do somewhat in video games, but not nearly as nuanced. If I start talking to you as a person, I could slip the wrong thing in what I'm talking. I could say something that I wasn't supposed to, a secret that I was supposed to not reveal. And that could be an interesting story path, whereas in a video game, I have 4 choices. And sometimes I don't even know what the choices are, because it just says sarcastic, you know, nice, you know, those kind of, it doesn't give you the full spectrum of what you're going to say.
This was before we started labeling things Paragon or Renegade options.
Yeah.
But even then,
the way Dragon Age did it, where they had the little icon to show intent of a little laughing mask if you were going to be silly, or cross swords if you were going to be aggressive.
Exactly.
Because oftentimes they're, text prompts were not terribly insightful.
But like even then, you can have sarcasm and it be in a nice way. Like, you're still sarcastic, but you're trying to be, you know, helpful. Or you can be sarcastic and be a jerk. There's things you can't do in a video game where you're trying to give that wide spectrum of styles.
To what extent are you able to mix newer players with veteran players?
That's actually pretty common with what I'm dealing with right now. I get some, well, I wouldn't call them veteran players, but they've played, you know, several games before. Maybe they played online.
How often do you see the veteran players do something that gives the newer players that aha moment? Where a situation's here and there are three obvious choices, and the veteran player does something completely off script. Mm-hmm. That just was not even vaguely in the cards. Total ass grab. And that gives the, or does it give, the other people at the table this sudden realization that, hey, I don't have to conform to the obvious choices, that there is a meaningful reward for going off path.
Well, sure. I had an interesting experience. Now, in this case, it didn't give them much of a reward, but it was something unusual, and it made the other players realize that they aren't in a box. The scenario that I was running was Death House from the back of the Curse of Strahd campaign, because it's an easy starter campaign. Sometimes I'll pull that one out with new players because it has investigation, a little bit of roleplay, and I know it well, so I don't have to think about it. I can throw the map down in 2 minutes. There is a spot in the house where you're supposed to go to the basement, but to get to the basement in the scenario, you have to go up to the third floor to find the secret door that goes down to down one of the, there's like a block about 5x5 on the map where it's a tunnel, essentially, that goes down a set of staircases, spiral staircase. But at the first floor of the map, you don't know that it's there. It's just a block that's, you know, a wall. It looks like a wall. Well, they finally realized there was a spot because they'd walked around the outside of the house, and then they walked around all the inside, and I'd drawn out the map of the inside. Well, there's a space where there's something that should be there that's not. And they realized there's that one of the veteran players goes, oh, I wonder if something's there, because they're looking for stairways to go down and they're not finding any. So they start trying to attack the wall, like break through the wall, which you can't do in a video game. In most video games, you can't break the wall. Like it's immutable, right? You could shoot it 1,000 times, even though you shoot a rocket launcher at a wall, it doesn't break.
Unless there's that one spot that you're supposed to be able to break.
Exactly. If it's not designed in there.
Yeah, I remember in the original A Rainbow Six game.
Yeah.
I took cover behind a wine bottle.
Exactly.
Because the wine bottle was simply terrain.
Yeah.
Yep. And so the wine bottle would just stop any size round that was thrown at it.
Yep.
Because, it was just background.
50 caliber to a wine bottle, it's no problem. It'll take it.
Yeah, and clearly it is rendered the same way as the background, unlike this other thing that is rendered in such a way that I know I can interact with it.
Yeah, I'm going to pin some of this on the Game Master, too, because I think it's incumbent on the Game Master not just to invite these options, but to validate these options. That if they start trying to attack the wall, and this is your first moment like that where you're really seeing them try something off script, then don't shut them down.
Maybe the wall has less hardness than it should.
Yeah, precisely. Be like, well, okay, maybe you can't punch through it or you can't pry it out with a longsword, but if one of you had a equipment pack that contained a crowbar or something equivalent to it in there, then you probably could start prying out bricks, and pretty soon, okay, I know the scenario says you're supposed to find it on the third floor, but no, you just found it on the first floor just by prying your way into it.
So I took this one in this case because it just happens to be that the house is actually haunted.
Yeah.
It is actually me. The house is just an illusion. It's not actually a house, but I took that as a way to make a clue for them to realize that it was haunted. When they started attacking the wall, the entire house shook. And things of that, like, I started giving them clues that there was something more to this than just it's a house. Because their job was to, literally, they got a couple of kids outside that are scared, say, hey, there's a monster in the house. Our parents were going to go deal with it in the basement. Help us. And, you know, tears, cry, you know, give them that emotional pull. And then they go into these guys, oh, yeah, we're big warriors. We can go deal with this monster. And they go into this house and they start finding out it's not what they expected it to be. That's the whole kind of first, like, act of this scenario. And you start to see the creepiness. It's a normal, it's a house, kind of got a little bit of creepy vibe going on the outside a little bit, but that's just the town. But then we start to unpack this idea that there's might be something more going on. And so when they started, you know, trying to hit the wall, they found it was harder than the rest of the walls. They could chip away at the other walls, but this one wouldn't change. And as soon as they tried to chip away at this wall, the entire house started shaking. And then eventually, if they continued that path, I would have triggered the house creating some sort of defense against being attacked, or locking the front doors, or sealing them in, that kind of thing. So it would trigger something else that would give them a reason to be interested in why is this happening, beyond just, okay, I could let them through, but they would miss out on so much storyline that was going on above them, and it's hard to bring that into the next stage.
So have you like noticed them developing specific personalities with their characters? Or yeah. is it something that they develop later on? Or
I think the first game, I get them at least to understand that they can have personalities. Mm-hmm. I don't expect them to pull out, like, in the first... But, you know, okay, we started at first hour one, and they're a brand new character, and then by hour four, they're fully fledged, deep emotional characters where they're making each other cry at the end. That's not likely to happen. Right. But not in a bar situation where we're all playing around a table with a bunch of other people around. It's not an intimate setting. But at least if I can get them to the place, they start thinking about, oh, this is a character in a story, not just a little mini that I'm putting on a table and that I'm fighting monsters. That they're actually thinking, okay, I am a character, rather than I'm a paper.
One of the difficulties in bringing somebody in from video games in particular, even if you're used to playing co-op video games, you're used to maybe working tactically with another player, but you're never, like, no video game does role-playing with other characters very well.
No.
Is there ever, like, is that a barrier, or is that something that you notice you're having to push or encourage people to role-play with each other, or see, not just see themselves as playing a character, but see everybody around the table as playing a character that is equally as part of this world?
The areas that I've found so far have been... It works really well if you have some older players that have played a few games or are a little bit more into it than the others, to kind of encourage that cross-party communication, create scenarios where they can talk together. But with the limited amount of time in this, since we're not running a full campaign, I think that that's been a challenge that I've not been able to overcome yet. Would I like to get to have some more time with these players and repeat, you know, consistency? I would try to create scenarios that their two player, once I figure out one of their two ticks, the things that they are, their personality types or their personality disorders, you know, depending on what it is, try to create connections.
Personality disorders. That's,
I mean, depending on what their player character, the character is and whatnot. So taking not their personal personality disorders, but their characters and finding ways to.
I'm running a game, new gaming group for Dark Triads. That's all I have in there.
But, you know, finding ways that you can pull their character quirks and find ways that you can try to get them to talk. I mean, that's just as much as I would do in a regular campaign, since they're just new players, right? These are all new players. They've never sat down. Hopefully they've sat down and read a book before, you know, but I mean, you've never seen them write a book with someone else. And that's a different type of thing than someone writing down a short story, even, you know, having to do that in school and write a story is different than trying to tell someone to write a 50-page book. Even it's a step that you have to push them slowly to.
Even just your standard group project is usually split up into you do this, you do this, you do this, and by the end we have a book, but we don't actually have to talk in the meantime.
Exactly.
Yeah, or one person does it all and everyone else just
sits there. As that person, yes. That's
same.
Actually,
I will say that in my experience of doing this, of taking someone who is a pure video gamer, moving them to role-playing games, to be honest, it's usually not a very clean transition. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because of the fact that they are accustomed to a level of visual presentation, a limited set of options, obvious prompts of what to do. And there's a question that I find interesting to ask, but I'm not sure I always suggest asking it. Because I think there really is a problem here, could be a problem here, of overthinking or overanalyzing a simple hobby choice and having them do the same thing. But the question that I'm oftentimes curious to hear answered, if I think is the sort of person I can ask, is why? So you played Baldur's Gate 3. Okay, that's cool. You want to play a role-playing game, tabletop role-playing game now, also cool. What's the connection? You think jumping from Larian Studios over to a tabletop, you're going to get what? Is it you want to try playing that same character? Is it just you like the aesthetic of the world? What specifically is it you are imagining that this experience is going to be like, such that it has become attractive to you?
Yeah, is this you've already played the game three times all the way through and you're tired of playing the same game? Or
yeah, precisely. Mm-hmm. And maybe you don't understand or fully appreciate the way in which these things are going to deviate. The ways in which a tabletop role-playing game is not going to be anything like a video game. I think for that reason, I have found it far easier to take people where their entry hobby, if we want to call it that, their gateway drug, isn't a game. It's some form of other narrative or storytelling. That these are people that are into theater, they're into writing, they're into storytelling, they're into freaking puppet shows, I don't, whatever. But it's something about communication, because I won't say there is absolutely no common ground between a tabletop role-playing game and an electronic role-playing game, because obviously there is. But the most obvious thing is just a mix of the rules and the things that populate the world. The fact that a kobold is a thing that exists and looks roughly like this and acts roughly like that and tends to appear over here in these ways. But the actual experience of playing Baldur's Gate 3 is going to be very different than playing especially a high RP role-playing game. Now, I'm not going to say that you can't jump from one to the other.
But and definitely not that you shouldn't.
Yeah, certainly not that you shouldn't. I still think that tabletop role-playing, and I love video games, but I think tabletop role-playing is the superior hobby because of what it allows. But I wonder if people sometimes make that jump from video games to tabletop games for all the wrong reasons. That what it is they're looking to recreate from the monitor to the tabletop is not something that's going to translate. Whereas some things are going to not only translate, but do better over there. But these may not be the things they're even thinking about. And I don't know. There's no one-size-fits-all answer to this.
I would rather give them that opportunity to try it and have them jump in and say, this is not for me, or I want to play the combat-oriented games, which there are plenty of those out there. Yeah. Those are not my style of games, but there are DMs who that's their thing. They take people through combat scenario to combat scenario. There may be a little story involved, but that's their focus is combat. And I want to see what you're interested in. If you're not interested in playing a combat game and you want to play a little more RP, I'm going to be here to provide that for you and to give you that to stretch you out and see if this is the right group for you. I would not take on a player in my own home game who I have not played, especially in like a D&D type scenario, if I haven't played with them in a one shot where I could see them explore their character even a small amount. Where on the other side, I would, you know, maybe somebody who's a video game focus and wants to look at pushing the buttons and that's all they're going to do. Totally good with playing with those guys in a one shot and letting it go.
Yeah, I absolutely would not discourage anyone from trying a tabletop role-playing game regardless of what it is that brought them there. If playing Baldur's Gate 3 gave them some idea that they might like tabletop role-playing games, they want to give it a try, I am fully and wholly in favor of that. If something brought you to the table, I mean, this is a niche hobby. It's getting bigger, but it's still not all that big of a hobby compared to most. And so I'm happy to see new players come in for any healthy reason. I guess I could probably give me enough time and I'll come up with someone I'd prefer not to be in the hobby. But any vaguely healthy reason to be in the hobby is good enough for me. But I hope one of the things that's communicated relatively quickly is that, okay, maybe Baldur's Gate 3 is what got you to sit down, but now forget Baldur's Gate 3. Sure. You're about to have a great time, but it's going to be a very different great time than what Larian gave you.
Absolutely.
That we're going to be doing something different here, And what you're going to enjoy is probably not at all what you were hoping to translate from the video game over to the tabletop role-playing game.
And that may just be because this is literally the only exposure you've ever had to these concepts. And so the ones you think you're going to bring over just aren't there or aren't the focus of the tabletop game.
You know, and this is something that I think we can relate to from the opposite angle. How many people sitting at this table have played a video game and at the end of that video game been like, damn, I want to knock out a role-playing game that basically plays like this video game so I can tell my own stories and experiment in the space. And to be brutally honest, it fails far more often than it works, because what made the video game work, the source of narratives, the kind of narrative control that's exerted over the characters, is not going to be there in a role-playing game.
The scripted story that you enjoyed so much is a scripted story, and it's not going to translate.
Precisely.
Either that, or you've spent 75% of the game literally in combat.
Yeah.
Yes, the story was good, but that's only 10% when you actually look at the actual amount of time you spent on it. 10% of it was story. If it's more than 10 to 20%, you're watching a show.
Yeah, or there's just
like
something...
Final Fantasy style, where it's been, you spend 15 minutes at cutscene.
Yeah.
You know, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's the thing, is that most video games are 10% story and 75% combat of some kind, except for Sims or something like that. You know, like...
Right, or they're The Last of Us, in which it is all story with some... You know, quick time events.
Or the werewolf, the other game that was in that same realm that was made, where you had, it was a story-driven choice games, that they've had several of them have come out.
Oh, the Telltale games?
Yeah, the Telltale series. Yes. So like the Telltale series, where it's all story-driven, it's just choice-based. Those are great, all those kind of things. When it comes down to it, is it's a completely different world that's sitting on a piece of paper and your imagination. What I love is the people who come from those video games and they want to write their own narratives that come after that. They're the guys who like play the game and go, some of them are a little more like, I want to ship these people or whatever. That's a little bit weird. But there are people who are like, I want to write a story based on this one-off character that was in the story. Why was he here? You know, what happened before? What happened afterwards? And create their own little short stories or create their own narratives that are going on beyond what was existing there. And of course, then you still have to say, well, this is that game. This is a new, you know, the game we're playing is different, but
yeah,
they can make that jump.
I think that's a point of contact that has to be understood by all parties, is I enjoyed a particular video game, role-playing game, movie, book, because of the fact that I interacted with it in a particular way. There was something about how a particular scene hit me, or characters hit me, or events hit me, or whatever, that really create a memorable experience, and I want those experiences to continue, or experiences like them to continue. I realize trying to recreate the exact situation is kind of foolhardy, but I want experiences like these to continue, and I don't know if the question is always sufficiently asked or answered of, can that thing, whatever that thing is, in fact really meaningfully be reproduced or be recreated? Once again, accepting that I'm not talking about a verbatim reconstruction, but is that something that was so unique to your interaction with this media that there really is no way that we're ever going to bring back that experience? And trying to jump over to a role-playing game is a great idea, just not for what you're looking at. For what you're looking at, this is really just beating a dead horse in a way. It's not going to respond.
So. Absolutely.
Well, and especially because you're talking about something hitting you in a specific spot, even if it's the same movie that four people watched, the thing that got to you is not necessarily going to be the thing that got to the other four people sitting around this table. So even if you manage to set up something similar in style, in setting, you're still probably not going to get exactly the thing that you got out of that media, whatever it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's where we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. Don't think there's going to be anything outside of time marks in the show notes. So as always, just have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2024. Listeners are free to use this episode in a non-commercial endeavor, so long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. If you wish to support this show and its related endeavors, you can do so at patreon.com/feartheboot.